Hundreds of young people in Hawaii have benefited from Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, known as DACA, which was brought about via an executive order from then-President Barack Obama in 2012. Obama hoped the program, which gave the children of undocumented immigrants, so-called dreamers, a chance to come out in the open, get renewable work permits, and get a foothold on American life. The Trump administration is hostile to the Obama initiative and has thrown a final decision on DACA to the Congress, giving it a six-month deadline and then somewhat muddying the waters by the president's comment that he would revisit the issue in 6 months. It leaves a great deal up in the air, and I spoke with Hawaii-based immigration attorney John Robert Egan yesterday. He pointed to the sheer numbers of people affected.
The fundamental problem is that here in the United States, we now have tens of millions of people who have come into the country either without any documents whatsoever or have come in and then overstayed the period of time that they were allowed to stay. And those people are now undocumented. Many of those people brought their children with them or their children have come to join them. And what are we going to do with those children as they now grow up, graduate from high school, and try to figure out what they're doing with their lives? Those are the people that we call the dreamers, because they're looking to fulfill the American dream. Congress has looked to try to solve this problem with a bill called the DREAM Act that's been put before Congress on a number of occasions but hasn't passed. So the problem that DACA was set up to work towards is to give those kids some breathing space while Congress figured out what they were going to do long term. Congress has not picked up the ball, and that's where it sits now.
Is Congress likely to pick up the ball?
Well, it certainly looks like it now. It looks like that's exactly what President Trump has intended in this action. We're going to push this off my table and put it on Congress's table and see what they're going to do about it. If it fails, it's not his fault, or so he would like us to think.
Well, he's also, but he's signaled pretty clearly his feeling about undocumented.
Well, he signaled quite a few things, and they don't all add up to one picture. He said that they're rapists and thugs and so on. And then he's also said that the Dreamers are wonderful kids and we should do something to help them. Well, he didn't really do very much to help them today.
What can a young person who has grown up knowing no other life but American life, what could happen to them? What is the perhaps the worst case of what could happen to them?
Well, starting right out, it's important for people who are in that situation to know that this program did not end today. Mm-hmm. They do not have to run and find shelter today.
Mm-hmm.
So the program is going to go on for the next few months, up through 6 months from now. Some of those people will actually be allowed to renew their status for another 2 years. So this is not an immediate crisis in the sense that children need to find shelter. However, in the longer term, there are people who have now been in the job market for 3, 4, 5 years who may be looking towards a future where their ability to work in the United States is rescinded. We have people right now who are traveling overseas because they were given permission to go visit family and are wondering, can they get back into the country right now? So there's a lot of things that are really unsettled about this, but primarily this whole idea that these children were allowed to begin adult lives, getting Social Security, getting the opportunity to go to work, getting identification so they could get a driver's license, all of those things are now back up in the air.
There's an enormous amount of disruption involved with the worst case scenario. Has the administration given a lot of thought to how it's going to go about ridding America of these illegals that it has, you know, made into kind of a bugaboo?
It does not look like they've given it a lot of thought, no. Honestly, what we're looking at right now is people trying to patch together a plan out of this announcement that was made today. No, it does not look like they have figured out how they're going to do this. It does look like they're actually intending to do a little bit of casting blame. Jeff Sessions today was talking about how DACA was somehow connected to organized crime from Latin America. Absolutely false. And that's not going to help to solve this problem, to be making those kind of accusations.
That kind of came out of left field. I hadn't heard that one before.
Yeah, I listened to his speech today. It was horrible. He's just he's never been a friend to immigrants.
Yeah.
All throughout his time in the Senate, he has opposed every loosening up or even fixing the immigration system. So it's not a good day that he's the one in charge of rolling out this program.
It doesn't seem as if the numbers add up in terms of creating immigrants as a real threat to American jobs. What did this anti-immigrant? What's the root of all this anti-immigrant sentiment that played such a strong part in the last election?
Well, I'm just an immigration lawyer. I'm not a political analyst.
Fair enough.
So I'm going to have to be a little bit circumspect about that. But if you were asking me in plain language, what is the problem? Racism.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, fundamentally, we have a lot of people in the country who are really not at all comfortable with the idea that America is becoming as diverse as it is. They feel that that's a bad thing and it needs to be stopped. So because that's not a particularly logical point of view, you need to do scapegoating. And that's where this whole idea that immigrants are stealing our jobs, that they're raping our women, that they're damaging our economy, that they're doing all these terrible things that they're not doing.
This is the old lawyer's thing of if you don't have the facts, bang on the table.
Well, I wouldn't blame it all on the lawyers, but yes, a similar sort of thing works for politicians, believe me. You know, I work with immigrants all day, every day, and I can tell you that that's not who they are.
Mm-hmm.
They are not criminals any more than anybody else. In fact, the statistics show that immigrants have less criminality than native-born Americans. They're not stealing our jobs. They're doing jobs that other people don't want to do. And it turns out that if you really look at the actual effect of immigrants on our economy, there tends to be a small bump upwards in the economy based on the effect of immigrants, partially because they're really entrepreneurial. They go out and start businesses. And when they start the businesses, who do they hire? People who are already here.
Mm-hmm. You've got clients who signed up for DACA.
That's right, I have.
And clients who didn't, right?
That's right.
So are the ones who did regretting it?
No. That's not what I'm hearing from people. I'm hearing people that are very upset about the fact that this is now becoming so uncertain. But I haven't heard of anybody who says, I wish I hadn't done that.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that people who have been, you know, in hiding, essentially, have been able to get into schools, have been able to find work, have been able to get a driver's license. Can you imagine being 18, 21 years old and not being able to even open a bank account?
Yeah.
No, I'm not hearing people who regretted it. I hear people who have deep trepidation about what's to come. But no, I don't think it's a matter of regret.
Well, some of that trepidation, I would imagine, you know, would come from suddenly finding yourself facing the prospect of being returned to a country you had never been in.
That's right. That's right. Many of these children came here as infants, some, you know, later on. But all of them have, in order to qualify for this DACA program, you have to have come to the United States before you were 16 years old. Now, you know, maybe this is legalese, but we don't hold people that age accountable for the decisions that their parents made. It's troublesome. Some of the kids don't even speak the language of their native countries anymore.
Sure. In Hawaii, with its sizable immigrant population and a lot of family members coming here to join their family, we now have a shifting definition by the administration of what a family is, right?
Well, they're trying to do that. You're probably talking about what they're doing with the travel ban.
Grandparents.
And trying to identify who is and who isn't an immediate relative.
Yeah.
Well, that gets a little bit arcane, but come on, guys. Everybody knows what a family is. You know who your family members are. And the idea that we should start picking that apart just doesn't make a lot of sense.
Well, we could be a long time waiting for a lot of things to make sense, right?
Well, yes, but I never give up hope.
You were saying that in fact, pushing DACA to Congress and saying to Congress, you decide, could actually offer some hope to immigrants.
Well, I'm maybe looking for the silver lining in this dark cloud. But yes, in fact, what these kids deserve is not a temporary fix, but a permanent law that brings them into the American family and gives them permanent residence, not just a renewable permission to be here, but give them full membership in the American community. They've earned it. They've grown up here. Some of these people are in the Army. Some people are in the military doing our work overseas. Mm-hmm. They've earned it. It's Congress's job to make the laws. That's where this should happen. If there's anything positive to be said about this, is that, yes, maybe there is a chance for them to do this. It didn't happen in the last 8 years because it was the policy of the Republicans to oppose everything that Barack Obama proposed.
It was seen as an Obama
right
initiative.
You know, and they didn't, you know, Obamacare, they've given him the laws his name so that they can make sure that it's personalized.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he's not there to be the bad guy anymore. They don't have to oppose this because it's Barack Obama's law. They get a chance to create their own law and see what they can do with this.
If they have to come up with reasons to oppose it other than that it's Barack Obama's, they might find themselves falling short of reasons.
Well, we don't accuse these people of deep reasoning anyway, but there will be some people who are opposed to it. There are some people who are opposed to it today. You'll read that in the media. But I believe that it's a smaller group than it was. The American public is in favor of this. 70-80% polling in the population at large across the country says, yes, we should give these dreamers a way to be here. Why is Congress not reflecting that? I think that there was a political situation, the confrontational feeling between the Republicans and Democrats for the last 8 years. It's their turn now. What can they do with this?
This will be interesting to keep track of, won't it?
It will be, and deadly serious for a lot of people.
John Egan is a senior attorney with the Honolulu-based immigration law firm Migration Counsel.
Hi, this is Chris Thiele inviting you to join us this weekend for a Prairie Home Companion from the Fitzgerald Theater. Our guests include the Avett brothers, Jessica Hoop, and the comedy of Jen Kirkman. Also on hand, the Royal Academy of Radio Actors, Tim Russell, Serena Brooke, and sound effects man Fred Newman, plus my song of the week, our salute to musicians' birthdays, and more, all right here.
Here at Prairie Home Companion, Saturday evening at 6.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, touting the benefits of early childhood literacy. But first, your quiz. In today's Backyard Quiz, we're plunging into the watery depths near Pu'amana for a glimpse of Hawaii's whaling history. Fondly remembered as a floating museum, the vessel we're interested in today was purchased by the Lahaina Restoration Foundation in 1973. It was then converted into a replica 19th century lugger, a kind of whaling supply ship, and the same kind that brought early missionaries to the islands. With no true historical value, the freighter featured exhibits on whales and the whaling industry. The ship wasn't designed to carry sailing rigs, so the hull was filled with 15 tons of steel and cement ballast to keep it from capsizing. Unfortunately, that trapped a lot of moisture, and the hull rusted inside and out, making it too expensive to maintain and repair. By 2003, the Lahaina Restoration Foundation was looking for a way out of junking the ship and found one when Atlantis submarine Maui took over the beloved Lahaina icon. So for today's quiz, can you tell us the name of this ship? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for today's programming comes from Maui Arts and Cultural Center, presenting the 12th annual Ku Mai Kahula Competition, featuring solo and group competitions, this Friday and Saturday, September 8th and 9th. MauiArts.org.
Figure skater Christy Yamaguchi came to worldwide fame as a 1992 Olympic gold medalist, and since then has found ways to leverage that fame in service of what she believes in, reading to kids. Her foundation is called Always Dream. She's in town for a weekend concert on ice to benefit children's literacy programs in Hawaii's Title I schools, and she's on the line with us now. Hi, Christy.
Hello. How are you?
Great. Thanks for taking the time.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
You've made this your cause, and why is it important to you?
Well, we know that reading and the love of books is the foundation for any child's academic success as well as life success.
Mm-hmm.
So if we can provide the materials needed to foster that love of reading, to foster the love of books at an early age, especially in the underserved areas, where they don't have easy access to those tools, that's what we want to provide and help provide, that chance for them to reach for their dreams.
Did you develop a love for books when you were little?
I did. I mean, I remember having my favorite books, and, you know, we did not have a whole lot of books in the house, but I do remember having my favorite ones and reading, especially as, you know, as I got older and enjoying the escape and the adventures in mm-hmm. books. So knowing, especially now, how important it is to develop those skills early on just for vocabulary and comprehension, those are just going to continue to help a child throughout their years.
Well, you know, Christy, when you hear of people who fell in love with books at an early age, they never stop. I mean, you don't hear people say, I loved books when I was a kid and then I lost interest. It tends to stay with you throughout life, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And, you know, especially when you develop that early on, then, you know, instead of at the third grade level, you start to read to learn. So that's a really critical time when you need to be up to speed and ready to move on to those other areas where science and math, where you are going to have to read to learn. So, but it is. It's books, I think, will continue throughout your life to open up new doors and adventures and especially dreams, and that's pretty much what it's all about.
Well, those first childhood experiences with books, to me, they're some of the deepest of one's life because you completely, a child who has first begun to read and falls in love with those first books is completely immersed in them in a way that it's, you know, you almost have to struggle to get back to that immersion later in life, don't you?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, a child's imagination is just, I think, beyond what we understand. And mm-hmm. they love to be read to, and they even love to hear the same story over and over, which is great for them because it's really sinking in at that point. But they absorb much at such a young age, and it's all making a difference for their development and everything.
Well, you make a good point about that third grade age when you start reading things that you kind of have to read. I think what you're saying is that we want kids to fall in love with the act of reading well before that stage. Is that accurate?
Absolutely. I mean, it's, I think, the best advice our pediatrician gave us, my husband and I, when we had our daughter, our first daughter. She was only about 6 months old, and he said, start reading to her now.
Wow.
And we were like, well, really? He's like, yeah, you might not think she doesn't understand, but just the fact of turning pages and her hearing the words and, you know, making those connections will help the development throughout. So we started reading to her early on, and, you know, parents don't know that. So if we can get that family engagement at home and really help teach them that, hey, this is definitely going to make a positive difference in your child and their development, and will make it, you know, put them on the right path to reading at grade level, especially by that third grade critical level.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that parents don't know that, because the whole thought of, you know, parents tend to think about waiting until a child is ready for something. And as we look back on our own experience of childhood, a lot of times we can remember being ready before adults thought we were ready, right?
Yeah, definitely. And another part of our program, it also integrates digital technology. So we introduce tablets into the classroom where digital books are also on the tablet, so the children get exposure to one technology, but also a different platform on which to read books. And, you know, they're so intuitive. They know what to do already, even at that young age. And even if it's their first exposure to that digital technology, they learn it so fast. So it's pretty amazing to see, but, you know, they need those resources in their hands to get that experience.
It sounds as if once those resources are made available, teachers don't have a problem finding enthusiasm from the kids. The enthusiasm is there. It's more a matter of getting the materials to them.
Absolutely, and that's where we hope to fill that gap and really hope to close that achievement gap with the underserved schools and the underserved children, to really be that provider of the resources, because the kids love it. And you know, we see it when we go into the classrooms. We're currently in 7 schools here in Oahu, and it's amazing to see their faces light up just to have a read-along or see them work with the tablets. So that's when we really see the program paying off.
Well, speaking of the tablets, I mean, it does, you know, a great many people are saying that books are sort of on their way out. The whole thing of the physical entity of a book is being seen as obsolete. They're not publishers are cutting back on the amount of books they're published. And so, you know, is it a medium that is sort of on the way out, or do we need to think about moving everything to electronic means?
I don't know if it's going to be one way or the other, especially I think for children's books in particular. Picture books are just the color and sitting on, you know, your grandma's lap or your auntie's lap and reading those books and turning the pages, I think will always be, you know, so special for a child. So I think having access to both and that exposure, yes, digital is here to stay, and it more and more will be leaning towards that. But I think for the children's space, hardcover books will still be very much a part of learning and just everyday household.
Well, Christy, you've taken your Always Dream initiative around the country. Do you get a good response wherever you go?
Yes. I mean, I think especially into the areas, we're very specific with the criteria of the schools we work with, the demographic of the children we're helping, and they have always been very receptive and grateful for the resources that we're providing them. And, you know, we're a small organization relatively, and we're looking forward to expanding and even reaching more kids. So, you know, this weekend we have a big benefit that will help raise awareness, but also funds for our programs that we have here in Hawaii, so we can continue to reach more kids.
Well, I join with probably a great many people in wishing you luck, Christy, and thanks for talking with us.
Great, yes. And if you could come out to Golden Moment, which is a skating show, this weekend, we would love to have your support.
Sounds great. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Christy Yamaguchi is an Olympic gold medalist, a children's book author, and an advocate for early childhood literacy. Her new production of Golden Moment, described as a concert on ice, it's at the Blaisdell Center this Saturday and Sunday, and you can learn more about it on our Facebook page, The Conversation.
Support for The Conversation comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, whose students contribute 60,000 hours of community service annually. Learn more at sacredhearts.org.
Homeless families making the transition to rental housing equipped with rental vouchers are stepping into a hot rental market, coming up against landlords with little incentive to rent to them. But as Civil Beat reporting fellow Natanya Friedheim has learned, some of the state's homeless shelters have been able to build relationships, one landlord at a time, that allow low-income families to put homelessness behind them. Hi, Natanya. Thanks for talking with us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
This is a kind of a hopeful story in an area where hopeful stories are pretty hard to come by, aren't they?
It is, yes. It's long been known that there's a stigma against homeless people and people who are on housing vouchers. Landlords are hesitant to accept these people as tenants because they're worried that these tenants won't take care of their units or won't, pay their rent on time.
Mm-hmm. What is it that eases their misgivings?
Well, a lot of homeless shelters are now offering an extra service, not just helping their homeless clients find units, but following them into becoming rehoused. They will check in with their clients or, these homeless people who have now found housing, make sure that they're treating the unit properly, they are adjusting well and making this unit into a home, as well as mitigating issues that might arise between the landlord and the tenant.
This is going directly to the landlord's misgivings, isn't it?
Exactly. And a lot of these shelter operators are arguing that accepting their clients might be safer than accepting some random person on the internet because you never know, who a stranger is. Whereas with these folks who are coming from the shelters, you have an extra a social worker following them into this rehousing process.
Well, and the shelter personnel have a strong incentive to have the rental agreement work out, just as the tenants do, right? So it's an added incentive for all concerned.
Exactly. The state recently added new requirements in their contracts to homeless shelters. The shelters are now required to house a certain percent of the people who are staying in the shelter. So in order to actually find these units, it helps the shelters to build these lists of landlords who, it might be a large property management company that has hundreds of units. And when one comes available, for some of the management companies, they'll reach out to, for example, the Institute for Human Services or other homeless shelter operators to offer up the units.
So they're, Natanya, they actually have a requirement to place some of their clients in housing, is that right?
Yes, yeah. That's actually something that Civil Beat reported on 2 weeks ago. The new homeless shelter contracts by the state require a certain percent of the folks staying at a homeless shelter to be moved into permanent housing in a certain number of days.
That's more than an incentive. That's a serious requirement, isn't it?
But it is because... Well, funding is now attached to this, these performance metrics.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Well, the numbers, are the numbers beginning to reflect this trend?
So it's hard to say because each homeless shelter has their own list of these, these property owners or property management companies. And it's hard to have a say of whether or not this is working. And the state's new contracts were implemented just a few months ago. So it's really a little too early to say if this new method is working.
Sounds as if we'll want to check back in with you about this story, Natanya. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat. Today, featuring reporting fellow Natanya Friedheim. Several listeners wrote or called in to respond to last week's coverage of the special session on rail, and some of those responses pointed to gaps between the general public's understanding of the Hawaii tax code and the way it really is. Tom Yamachika, president of the Tax Foundation of Hawaii, has had the same experience, and in the wake of discussions of the TAT and the GET, we asked him to help us sort it all out.
A lot of the arguments that have been made, you know, even to the to the point before they just voted on it, was that, hey, this is Honolulu money being used to fund a neighbor island project.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is that when you're talking about state tax, like the transient accommodations tax, it funds projects on all islands,
mm-hmm.
and they can go wherever the legislature wants it to go. I mean, there's a provision in our Constitution that says the legislature shall have the power to apportion the state tax among the various counties, and that's what they do.
So you had given the example we were talking earlier of Maui Memorial Hospital, which everyone statewide chipped in to build, right?
Right. Maui Memorial is a state hospital. State money was used to build it. Same thing for Honua Pi'ilani Highway.
Mm-hmm.
I'm picking on Maui. I don't know why. but if Honolulu said, well, geez, we're not going to have any of our 80% used to fund their project, then, yeah, we would have a very different Maui.
Mm-hmm. Or any other neighbor island project of any size.
Right. That's true.
So who determines what projects get state money? The legislature,
the
elected
legislature,
officials.
Yes. So it's a political question as to, you know, which projects are funded in which districts, on which islands. But that's always how it's been.
We had a caller in response to one of our recent discussions from Maui objecting to the surcharge to the state excise tax as something that placed a burden on her. Does it?
No. The GET surcharge is only on Honolulu businesses and residents.
Mm-hmm.
It applies only to business within the city and county of Honolulu.
Now, when the discussion in the special session centered on TAT increase versus adding a surcharge to the general excise tax, what were the issues in that discussion? What are the merits and demerits of either pathway?
Well, the hotel industry was very upset about using the TAT for anything, especially since there is nothing in the Honolulu Rail that is even remotely related to the visitor industry.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least that's what they say. The other thing to worry about is that when you extend the GET surcharge, I mean, it already is up to 2027.
Mm-hmm.
So any new money is going to be coming in from 10 years out. And if you need the money now, which apparently is what, you know, they need the money now or very soon, you need to borrow it because you're not going to be able to finance something you need now with money coming in from 10 years out.
So what we got out of that deal was collateral, in effect, to borrow more.
Right. And if you borrow, there's going to be interest. Even if you raise it on the bond market, there's going to be an interest charge. It may be like maybe 3 or 4%, you know, much better than, you know, we normal people can get. But there will be something.
So that that money that will come in from an excise tax surcharge is going to go largely to debt service for money that we need now. Is that right?
Yeah, a lot of it would.
So that would seem to be another argument in favor of raising what we can now. And that's the TAT side of the argument.
Yeah. Right. Actually, I did some rough calculations about what the financing cost on 10 years of $250 million a year would be,
mm-hmm.
right, if you need it now. And the answer was roughly $1 billion.
Strictly in money paid to the banks, in effect.
Yeah, the banks or whatever investors.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the argument that has prevailed is what? Increase to the TAT. It's a little of both, right?
Right. So you have a 1% increase to the TAT until basically 2030,
mm-hmm.
and a 3-year extension of the GET until the same end year.
Another of the arguments that was made against this particular arrangement was that it ties up an awful lot of money for future needs that we don't even know about yet, or even existing state needs.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that the House Speaker said, and it's very troubling to hear, because that means he has ideas for raising the GET for something else.
Well, what would those something else's be? I mean, we have to prepare for disasters. We have infrastructure to be constantly updated, right?
Well, the biggest gorillas right now in the state budget are so-called other post-employment benefits.
Mm-hmm.
So you have your state workers. You've made a promise to take care of them after they retire with a defined benefit plan, and also for health care for life.
That's a bubble that has yet to burst, isn't it?
That's correct. There have been some actuarial studies that seem to put the liability close to maybe $20 billion, but those assume that the money that is currently in ERS can be invested to earn a rate of return of around 7%. Nobody gets 7% these
days. That's pretty optimistic. That's retirement money that was going to fall behind its obligations, in a sense.
Yeah, so if you instead use a tax-exempt rate like how we're getting today, the amount of underfunding goes, I think, from $20 billion to $35 billion or more.
What we're talking about is an awful lot of financial obligations the state is going to face in the future, for which it is apparently not prepared. Is that safe to say?
I think that is safe to say. I mean, there are a lot of people at the legislature who are in denial. They don't think it's ever going to happen. Oh, we can take care of it when the time comes.
Well,
but is that really true? I don't know.
You know, the trouble with the whole electoral structure is that if a problem is delayed 20 years, it's somebody else's problem if you're an elected official.
Right. So there is, of course, a lot of pressure to, not incur the pain, pawn it off on somebody else.
The proverbial kicking the can down the road.
Yes. Yes. That happens a lot.
Tom Yamachika is the president of the Tax Foundation of Hawaii and the founder of the law firm Aloha State Tax.
Aloha, I'm Luther Dickinson from the North Mississippi All-Stars, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Next Radio Lab, the story of an Algerian-German immigrant who moves to Venice and upends a 900-year-old tradition.
And then the trouble began.
The gondolier. That's on the next Radio Lab.
Saturday morning at 10.
Earlier today, we told you about a floating museum that had been an integral part of Lahaina's landscape since the early 1970s. Originally built in 1920, the 97-foot steel-hulled vessel was re-rigged to resemble a 19th-century whaling supply ship called a lugger, the same sort of ship that brought Hawaii's early missionaries. The ship's hull was filled with 15 tons of steel and cement ballast to prevent capsizing, but there was water mixed in with it, and the hull rusted out. Lahaina Restoration Foundation, that owned the ship, found it too expensive to maintain and repair, and instead of letting the beloved ship get scuttled in deep water, Atlantis Submarine Maui acquired her and let her settle 95 feet down on a sandy bottom half a mile off Lahaina between Pu'amana and La Niupoko Park as an artificial reef. That happened on December 13, 2005, and the Carthaginian II, once a tourist favorite as a whaling museum, is now appreciated by fish as an underwater housing project. And Nancy Vendrell of Wailuku knew that it was the Carthaginian II. A lot of people guessed Carthaginian, but Nancy knew about that Roman numeral II. So she's today's winner of today's quiz. And that's today's quiz. If you've got one for us, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Participation in social media is no longer optional for a wide range of businesses, a fact of modern life that has caught a great many business operators by surprise. How do you jump into what has become a fast-moving stream and reap the benefits of what has become a separate economy of its own and a goldmine for those who have been savvy enough to exploit it? Danielle Miller is a social media specialist who's giving a free workshop next week on Maui on the ABCs of social media marketing. She's with us by phone. Hi, Danielle.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me on today.
Sure. You've been in this world for a while, but it's new to a lot of people, isn't it?
Very new to a lot of people. And even though I've been in it for a while, it's constantly changing.
Changing how?
Well, there's always updates to Facebook's layout or their algorithm. There's always new networks popping up like Instagram or Snapchat. And there's always different strategies that business owners can use to reach potential customers via social media.
You know, I see on all kinds of products, I see these social media handles, you know, on a tube of toothpaste, it says, reach out to us on Facebook. And I thought, why would I want to talk on Facebook about toothpaste? But, I mean, I'm exaggerating. You know what I'm saying, though, right?
I do. But the way brands are using social media now is to connect with consumers on a whole nother level. Mm-hmm. If you have a favorite brand of toothpaste that you want to recommend to other people, social media makes that really easy for you to do. It also helps you get ideas for, you know, other ways you might use that tube of toothpaste. Sometimes social media is the perfect venue for that toothpaste company to let you know that you can use toothpaste to clean your kitchen sink. You know, those little life hacks and tips.
Uh-huh. It's also created this whole new economy of people who, you know, celebrities who tell you what they brush their teeth with this morning, and you're supposed to follow along with them, right?
Oh, that is so true. That's the influencer market.
Yeah.
So right now, a lot of businesses are connecting with people who already have social media followings, and they're leveraging their community in order to introduce wonderful products and support really cool businesses.
Well, you can, if you become a, what was the term you just used? A
influencer.
If you become an influencer, you can make a fortune by saying, I just had a really good cup of coffee this morning, and then I brushed my teeth, and then I, you know, whatever, right?
You sure can. A lot of the businesses that I work with now, part of our social media strategy is always to identify these influencers and try to partner with them, whether it be co-hosting an event or offering them some free products in exchange for their opinion or offering to, you know, take them out on an adventure. A lot of the tourist companies here in Maui benefit from bringing these social media influencers out on their activities so that they can share the fabulous pictures on Instagram or Facebook.
So they say, I went on a zip line this morning. What a great time I had. And then suddenly everybody wants to do that, right?
That's the idea, yes.
It seems to be paying off in large areas, but, you know, for, say, for a business owner who has some sort of a product or service they want to get out there, and they are completely, you know, they're social media virgins, how do they learn all that? How do they jump into this river?
Well, some of the best ways to learn this is definitely just start playing around. Just get out there and start using the social media networks. And then attending the free classes. So we have one free class coming up tomorrow at the Maui County Business Resource Center.
Mm-hmm.
That's the ABCs of social media marketing.
Mm-hmm.
And then next week on Thursday evening, I'm also partnering with Akaku upstairs to deliver part of their salon series, a talk on how to manage your personal Facebook privacy settings and how to make sure you're using it for personal use, too. So you can become not only a better consumer, but also if you see the business aspect, you know, you can come to tomorrow's class and get a lot of actionable steps for how to use it better for business.
Well, thinking about the business side for a moment, our business is somewhat wary about the whole thing that you hear with social media of maybe making too much information available to too many people. Is there a downside to all that?
There sure is, in my opinion. When I talk to business owners, one of the bad habits that I see that I try to help them break is the overposting. Really, the simplest mantra that any business owner can hold with them when it comes to social media is quality over quantity. You don't want to muddy your brand by posting every day just because you think you have to put something up every day. It's really more important that you deliver the meat of the information, stuff that's really actionable and what I would call share-worthy. And that is when customers find more value in following businesses on social media.
Well, Danielle, I'm very glad to hear you say that because I think a lot of people who first delve into social media are amazed by how trivial some of the messages are. You know, I stepped off the curb and walked across the street. Well, who cares, right?
Right, Chris, that is totally on point. Don't tell me that you stepped off and, you know, stepped off the curb and walked across the street, but I'll tell you, if you just were leaving a fantastic massage, you know, you just got a great massage at a spa and you want to give them a shout out, tell me about that. You know, to start leveraging and connecting people. Don't, you know, a lot of businesses tend to think social media is only a tool to promote themselves when really they can use it as a tool to leverage the connections and network that they have developed. And really, businesses can partner together and talk about each other. It's better for a business on social media to get somebody else to talk about you. You don't want to tell everybody else how good you are yourself. You want somebody else to do that for you.
So you might sort of say to a business colleague, I'll praise you if you praise me?
Sure, or you know, I'll give my honest review of our exchange or business if you do the same for me, and that way we end up promoting the really quality businesses.
Are the business people you talk to, are they receptive to this, the message that you bring?
You know, the people who are willing to come to the classes that I teach through Adventures at UH Maui, or who come to my classes at the Business Research Center, or who take my 8-week mastermind program, they are making a commitment to learning, and they're already open-minded. It's the folks who maybe I meet at different meetings, like if I go...
Danielle, I think I just lost you, but I'm sorry to say we're out of time anyway. Danielle Miller will offer a free workshop on the ABCs of social media marketing tomorrow at noon at the Maui County Business Resource Center in the Maui Mall in Kahului. You can learn more about Danielle and her work on our Facebook page, The Conversation.
Twitter feed, Facebook, LinkedIn, YouTube, Google Plus, and Instagram.
I'm Mr. Social Media. Are there way too many of me?
Twitter feed, Facebook, LinkedIn, YouTube, Google Plus, and Instagram. Twitter feed, Facebook, LinkedIn, YouTube, Google Plus, and Instagram.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
You know that little sticker on fruit, how when you pick it off, it, like, damages the fruit?
And then trying to flick it off your fingers, right? And you're like, why does it have to be so hard?
That is design. And design affects everything around us.
And if done right, everything around us could be transformed to bring a better experience.
Ideas about the power of design, that's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Saturday at 3 p.m.
And that's it for today. Up tomorrow on The Conversation, what homeowners need to know about flood insurance and welcome advice on how to keep your head when all about you are losing theirs. We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments at this number, 808-792-8217. You also can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation. If you missed any of this show or want a past one, find them on The Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under talk shows for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.